Hi, I'm your host Keshav Chauhan and this is Milliseconds, an attempt at personifying all of the things we see but don't think about. A driven leader of high-performing research, design, data science, and digital transformation strategy teams that uncover business and user requirements for innovative, customer and user-centered technologies, services, and products in the enterprise. Evelina is the head of experience at ChaiOne, an IT services and IT consulting firm. With a PhD in psychology and an MBA, she leads cross-functional teams with an unwavering focus on human-centered design. This episode focuses on designing for the future, the vast implications of psychology, mindful UX, and all the things that we see but don't think about. Apologies in advance for the not-so-great sound quality at some points during the episode. Hope the insights you take from this will be able to overshadow the same. Hi, Evelina. Really excited to have you on the show. Like, it's the first time I'm talking to someone with a PhD, so yeah, very excited for the same. So how has 2021 been for you?
Hi, pleasure to be here. 2021, it's always an adventure. Learning from experiences and from others, and moving one day ahead.
What does that mean, moving one day ahead?
Just focusing on what you can do today, where you can have an impact today, and keeping your chin up and trying to find the positives in life.
What are some of the things that you did in 2021, which you have not done in the past years? Anything unique?
Working from home all the time, that's unique to my experience. But also meeting and networking with a lot of people from different countries and different states inside the United States and different places of work. People that I would not have really met through other ways except in person at conferences. So the pandemic gave us a unique way for all of us to really think about meeting other people and continue to learn from each other in some novel ways that I hope will persist after the pandemic is over.
Yeah, don't you find it ironical that with 2021 being completely virtual for most of the countries in the world, we have met more people as compared to we could have met in real life? Don't you think that?
Yeah, it's interesting. It definitely changed our perspective of what is normal.
Yeah, that's true. So now, how does a day in your life look like in ChaiOne as head of experience?
So ChaiOne is an agency where we advise and consult Fortune 500 clients, and specifically clients that are pursuing a digital transformation journey. So they're investing in technologies in hopes of making things better, more efficient, more profitable. So in my role at ChaiOne, I oversee and coordinate the work of researchers, designers, data scientists, and digital transformation strategists. And in my role, I help connect the dots between what the different teams are doing so that it becomes a more uniformed, more streamlined service for our clients. So I spend a lot of time working with the different teams, learning about what they do, and I draw parallels of their work to the work that other teams are doing. I also spend a lot of time talking to clients and learning about their challenges when they're going through their digital transformation journeys, what goals they have, what objectives they have, what has worked for them in the past, what hasn't worked for them, what challenges they anticipate, whether that's culture of their employees or of their customers or some technical boundaries or regulations that they deal with. And so I gather that information so I can determine if there's some way to advise them based on the expertise that my team has on how we can help them on the digital transformation journey and the path forward. And then the last thing that I do is I try to stay informed and learn new things all the time. So I read, I watch webinars, I meet with people and I talk about what they do and how they solve new challenges in their work.
Yeah. Is it like a fast-paced life working with a consultancy?
Agency life is definitely fast. I spent many years working in academia, in a university setting, and doing research there. And compared to academia, industry and agency work is much more fast-paced, yes.
Yeah, I think in university you get a lot of time to think about things because they generally know that it takes time for research. But with consultancy, you have a set time frame to do stuff, so I think that's where it becomes faster as compared to the university area.
Yes, I think a lot of university deadlines, most of them are self-imposed by researchers. There's definitely deadlines that come from external sources when you are applying for grants and you have to get funding, or you are applying and you want to submit presentations to conferences. So there are external deadlines, but overall it's researchers have a lot of say in the deadlines that they create for their own projects.
Yeah. So in a consultancy, like in a consultancy environment, do you work with different firms? Like, so they are every, so you know, after a point of time, you change the firm that you're working for, right? So it's like working for different firms and different challenges. So how do you cope up with that? Like,
yes, we definitely work with a lot of different customers. We have. Yeah. Become much more specialized in terms of the industries that we serve. So we work primarily with industrial services, construction. So for example, construction or scaffolding and blasting service providers. We work with energy, power, oil and gas customers, primarily because our company is headquartered in Houston, where a lot of oil and gas companies also have their headquarters. So we have become more specialized in what types of industries and what types of clients we serve. So we can learn from those clients and apply similar lessons to other projects. But the challenges and opportunity areas, even for different clients within the same industry, are unique. And it is exciting for me to be able to take something that I've learned in one place and apply it in another place with some modification or building on what I've learned before to the new problem that we're trying to solve. So I like that the expertise for our team expands because we're working in a specific sector, and yet there's still room for creativity and for nuances when we're problem solving with a client.
I think that's the reason why firms prefer a T-shaped skill set, because you'll be changing industries a lot when you're working. So yeah, that's why you need to have a broader set of skills and also a specialized skill. So I think that's
well, another reason. It's either you are T-shaped or you have a diverse team that's working with the clients. It's very rarely a one-person project. Usually you have experts from multiple parts of the business that support projects.
Yeah, I think a team of specialists a team of T-shape, or one T-shape, I think, yeah, that's also viable. So, you know, I recently saw one of your tweets that mentioned the idea of mindful notifications, which sounded really fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. So why do you think it has not been implemented yet?
Yeah, that was a really great article. I don't remember the author, but it really spoke to me because we are constantly bombarded with notifications. Our apps, our laptops, our other devices are fighting for our attention. It's a message on Slack. It's a email, it's a calendar notification, somebody, you know, a news article that just got posted. And presently, most of those notifications are of the same urgency. They are all a red dot, or they're all a pop-up, and there's nothing that distinguishes and says, I am more important than this other notification. There's no notification that says, hey, this is an interesting thing for you to look at, but it's not urgent. And so there's a lot of fighting for our attention, and it's exhausting for humans. And I am a cognitive psychologist by training. So even though we may not really realize this as humans, it is wearing on our mental health and well-being when we have a lot of this, I call it noise, fighting for our attention. And I think tech companies, because this is not a novel problem, other designers and technology experts and psychologists have talked about this before. Technology companies are becoming, beginning to realize that there are ways to design better notifications for a better user experience, as well as for better well-being of all the users. So if you think about Apple's focus time, you can set a time when you're no longer being disturbed, and you can still allow certain types of notifications to reach you, whether that's from people or from certain apps. So companies are taking steps to make it happen. And I really look forward to seeing some prioritization of notifications that would say, like, I am really urgent, pay attention to me, versus, hey, this is something that you might be interested in, just a little nudge for you to take a peek at this news article because you're interested in this specific topic. So I think we're on our journey there, and time will tell, if we get there.
Yeah. I really don't see a point when why people turn notifications on, to be honest. It's not necessary for me.
Well, I actually go and turn off most notifications by default. But the fact that I have to take that step to turn everything off, it's frustrating. Every single app you download automatically says, can I track the location and can I send you notifications?
Yeah. Let's see where we go, because I think I'm in a metaverse imagining how notifications will work. It's like very different from the physical thing that we are used to, because we are a step closer to blending technology with the real life. Mm-hmm. So I think there needs to be a kind of good focus area for these things, because it distract us from everyday stuff a lot as compared to the things that we don't think about. So yeah, that's very interesting. Let's see where it's heading. So now you're also a lecturer currently at the University of Houston, a place where you also studied for 10 years. So how do you feel now when looking back?
So I started teaching there when I was still a graduate student, and I've been able to continue teaching. So it's like I've never left, except I graduated. I teach upper level psychological statistics class, and I teach cognitive psychology to undergraduate psychology majors. And both of these classes are very near and dear to my heart. I am a cognitive psychologist myself, and so I get to pass on some of the knowledge to my students. And it's very exciting when they find certain topics of cognitive psychology interesting and exciting to them. For example, we learn how people learn language, or how people remember or forget, or how people remember false information of things that actually didn't happen, although it feels like certain things truly really happened in their life. So it's a pleasure for me to see that students actually begin to think about how we think and how our mind works. So I really enjoy doing that. And teaching statistics is also really great because it teaches the students to be critical, or at least more critical, consumers of information. And if it teaches them to evaluate data a little bit more critically before believing that something is or is not true.
Yeah, the idea sounds very intriguing to me as well. Is it like a kind of a blend between data science and user experience?
It is more about how we measure things in life, and how do we know that some things are actually different or not different, such as students who spend 3 hours studying do better on a test versus students who spend 2 hours studying but they take a break in between do better on a test. How do we know which studying method actually is better, or are they any different? And so if we do a study where we test this type of a hypothesis, We will be able to use statistics to determine whether the grades that students get are truly different or they just may feel like they're different, but they aren't. So statistics allows us to make decisions about whether something that we have observed is really true or just looks like it may be true.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned a term called language when you were talking previously, and it took me on a tangent completely. So do you know, I'm very intrigued by the fact that emojis are able to transcend the communication barrier, and every person in the world can relate to what an emoji means.
Yeah.
Do you think in the future there might be some kind of technology that could help us communicate with another person so that we don't need to learn learn their language which they speak?
Yes, I am sure that there are linguists who are and cognitive scientists and cognitive psychologists who are looking at this closely and much more deeply. So you may be right that we may have a written or spoken language to emoji translator.
Oh, yeah, that sounds very, very interesting. You know, what are some of the things that you miss from your PhD days now that you're working?
There are a few things that I miss. I enjoy a lot of what I do, and I have a lot of fun being in my role. But there are a few things that I miss occasionally. So I miss being surrounded by people with deep levels of expertise, and specifically deep levels of expertise in many different areas. So in technology, that's where I work. I'm surrounded by experts in design, experts in research, experts in data science, business strategy. But I don't get to talk to people who study fish or who study physics or who study exercise or health. So I miss spending time with people who are really nerding out about a topic that I don't deal with every day. And I miss hearing things like, let's go listen to a talk about cyber threats on our power grids. Or let's, talk about this paper about exercise impacting our brain. So in academia, access to that kind of information and those types of discussions happen all the time. Even if you are studying something very different from people. So I miss that a little bit, or a lot, depending on the day. I also miss the peer review process. And this is an experience that when you as a researcher do a study and you run a study or you do an experiment, you collect the data, you analyze the data, and you come to some conclusions, you present that research to your peers who are other scientists. And when you're presenting that research, whether that's a conference presentation or it's a paper that you wrote and you want to publish in a scientific paper or scientific publication, your peers have to evaluate how you did the work and whether your conclusions make sense and whether your conclusions are justified based on the method that you used and the analysis that you did. And what it does, really, when your peers look at the work that you've done, they question your assumptions, they question your methods, they question your interpretation of data, and they provide opportunities to look at your own work through different angles and through different lenses. And as a researcher, you may have done everything super, super well, but defending your work kind of solidifies that you did the work well, or it highlights that there may be some limitations to how you collected the data or how you should interpret the results that you got. So it kind of keeps the scientist honest. And in my many years of experience in industry to date, I can count on one hand the number of people that have challenged my research methods. And on the one hand, it's really great because my clients and my colleagues trust me to be an expert in what I do, which if I don't have to fight for everything that I do, you know, I can get a lot more work done. But at the same time, if nobody challenges me, or at least nobody asks questions that make me pause and think about what I'm doing, I have fewer opportunities to learn and fewer opportunities to really step back and reflect on what it is that I'm doing. And of course, I have research peers and colleagues. You know, we have conversations about the methodology and why we may choose one method over other. But having the external scientists look at the work that I would be doing would be a more rigorous way to learn for myself and to do the work that I do. So that's another thing that I miss. You had a question?
Yeah, so that line was very cool when you mentioned that you can count on one hand the number of people that have, you know, pointed out a mistake on your research or on your research methods. Yeah, that seems really cool. You know, when you are in PhD, does it happen that now that you know so much about one field, so that you get excited for many things at the same time? Did it happen to you?
Yes. So let me first talk about the mistake in research. So it's peer review is not. It can catch mistakes if you've done them, but it's also just tell me more about why this method applies here. I don't understand. I don't follow. Or like you are making certain assumptions about using this method, but maybe those assumptions are not really fully thought out. Or maybe you have not thought about this particular situation where your method might not work. So it's not just you need a peer review to catch your mistakes. It's being very critical about the problem you're trying to solve, right? And that's kind of where having just a second pair of eyes, like when you're doing design. If you have another designer come look at your design, they may suggest certain things that could change your product for better or could enhance it in some way that you didn't even think, right? So that's kind of the point of peer review in science. And I'm sorry, I missed your question.
So I was saying that when you're doing a PhD, now that you know so much about one field, so did it happen to you that you get excited about many things at the same time?
I am excited about many things at the same time. And what I have realized over time is that when you are a scientist in academia, you become an expert in one field and you know many, many, many things. You may be one of the 5 or 10 experts in the world on a very specific topic. And that's important in academia. When you have the research skills from this academic background in the industry, where I see the value of that is that we have the knowledge of how to ask questions and how to answer questions, regardless of the domain expertise. And of course, domain expertise matters. You can't just go in and start, you know, studying doctors without understanding how, you know, medicine works in the specific culture. You have to have some domain knowledge for sure, but at least we have the skill set to begin asking questions regardless of the domain expertise. Questions that help us learn new things.
Yeah. You know, I think that when someone knows a lot about one field, then he discovers the kind of, area that field has in common with all the other fields that he knows about. For example, when that you know a lot about psychology, then you may also know about the psychology of a pencil, which sounds very weird, but yeah, so something like that. You know, you can branch out in any way possible when you know a lot about one field. That's kind of what I think.
I have realized that I am more curious about many different things now than I used to be when I was in academia. And maybe it is the perspective that I am not in academia today and I have stepped back and I have learned some of the skills of how to ask questions. And so I do find many things interesting and curious. And that's one of the other things that I miss about academia, to be honest, is that in academia, you have opportunities to ask questions simply for the sake of knowing. In industry, everything that you do has to be justified. It has to be practical. You have to be able to use the results in some way. You have to justify why you're spending your money and how that's going to impact the business. But in academia, there is value to doing research simply for the sake of knowing. Maybe what we learn today is going to be applicable 1, 2, 10, 50 years later, but at least we have the opportunity to satisfy our own curiosity. I wonder how this works. Even if nobody cares, I'm just kind of curious how this works, right? I don't have opportunities to ask those types of questions in industry.
Yeah, because curiosity can't be automated. So,
well, it's not just curiosity. It's who's going to care about this and who's going to want to spend money, you know, to do the research to answer that question.
Yeah. Is it your curiosity that, made you do an MBA after a long gap of like 8 years, right? If I'm not wrong.
It's a little bit of it is curiosity. I have also realized that I could improve certain skills. Because I work a lot with different business stakeholders, I decided that it would be valuable for me to understand how businesses work in general, how business leaders make decisions. So if I understand that, I can be a better consultant and advise them better because I can then speak their language and see the world a little bit more from their perspective.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So, we are living in times where for many of us, our time spent virtually is now more than our time spent in the real world. And it's going to definitely increase in the future. And there's this movie which I saw a couple of weeks ago, Ready Player One. And that movie was the first one, I think, to explore the concept of a metaverse, where the real world is almost destroyed in the movie. And people mostly live in a virtual world inside a game. And I think that's what we are headed towards as well. And, if that happens, people will find it very hard to deal with reality. And I think that's one of the industries that will rise after like 10, 15 years is psychologists will be like on top of the career options well after 10, 5, 15 years. What are your views on this?
So first of all, I would recommend anybody who has not read the book, Ready Player One, to go read the book.
I also read it.
I really enjoyed the book. I was a little bit disappointed with the movie. So I think we all have a role to take in shaping what future we create for ourselves. And by saying we all have a role, I include not just us as individuals, across the globe, but also tech companies, governments, and all sorts of organizations, profit, nonprofit. And we have to ask ourselves, what do we as governments, as tech companies, as consumers want to spend our money and time on? And what is not important to us? So just some questions for us as a society to think and reflect on, I think is helpful. And what's interesting about your question is that over the last 1 to 2 years, I've been learning and reading a lot about futurism. And it's a way to think about the world, and it's really a tool to help us think about and prepare for and shape the future that we want to experience, rather than just sit and wait passively for the future to happen. Futurism gives you tools to think about the possibilities of the future, and we could have a very dystopian idea of the future, such as we all live in a headset and we don't interact with each other really. But perhaps there are other possibilities where we do have headsets, we are engaged with each other, but yet our personal and kind of in-person life still is very active and very successful. And so futurism gives us ways to forecast, maybe, or imagine those possibilities and choose what we want to actually help make happen. Yeah. And, you know, maybe the immersive reality will not replace our real world experiences. I think we are social creatures in general, and we do need interactions with others, but not just we need to, you know, get on a video call and be in a virtual space together, but we do need nature. There's many psychology studies that show that we do better as human beings in nature, and I don't think that all parts of nature can be simulated through digital means. We do need to touch each other. We do need to touch pets and animals and just have that experience that I think will be very difficult to replicate in some digital means. At least I really hope that we cannot replicate that and that we will be able to continue living in this 3D analog world rather than 3D digital world.
Yeah, it's the same with me as well. So now if you were to pick one option of these two, so in the future, where do you think we are headed? Like humanizing technology or technologizing humans?
I think a lot of... Yeah, there's a lot on both sides.
Yeah.
As examples I can point to. My preference is humanizing technology.
Yeah, same. That's the same. Yeah. So, you know, yesterday's graphic designers are today's UX designers. And in the future, we'll definitely see new roles coming up as we are building the metaverse. So, you know, one of the roles that got me excited was that of a fusionist. So, like a person responsible to act as a fusion between design, art, data science, and research. And you're almost in the same zone as that of a fusionist in today's world. So, what are the challenges that you face while working on the kind of projects you work at?
Yeah, so I have not heard the fusionist title before, but it does sound similar to at least some of the things that I do, which is, again, connecting the dots between researchers, designers, data scientists, and strategists when they are helping clients meet certain objectives. So our projects differ, and who's involved and what specific things they may do on a project varies greatly based on what the clients need. But I can give you a couple examples of how these different teams work and how I, in that role of connecting the dots, help move those projects along forward. So one of our clients has a data science team, and they analyze sensor data. And from that sensor data, the client stakeholders make various decisions for their business. And what we learned was that these data scientists have never gone out to see where the sensors are placed and what happens with the equipment that has the sensors when people are around that equipment and when people are doing their day-to-day job. So researchers from our team went to the field. They actually saw how people work with the equipment, when the equipment is used, when the equipment isn't used, how people make decisions around the equipment. And we learned that a lot of stuff that happens outside of the sensor actually impacts what kind of data the sensor records. And so the sensor data that's analyzed by data scientists absolutely has to be taken into account in this bigger picture of a whole process and the human system that allows those sensors to collect data. Because otherwise, if you are just crunching numbers and you don't understand the context in which those numbers are captured, you are going to make wrong decisions, because that the context in which those sensors are working differs, and we need to be mindful of that. So I help researchers and data scientists communicate and speak the same language. And then our data scientists worked with a client's data science team to help them make changes to their work based on what we've learned in the field from researchers. Mm-hmm. So there's some of that work that we do. In another project, we design interfaces that present a lot of outputs from complex data science models. And the output from those data science models is very technical, but it has to be used by non-technical, non-expert users. So we have to help designers and data scientists speak to one another and find a common ground of how data science outputs can be visualized in a way that's intuitive, easy to learn, easy to understand, in a way that prompts the correct, easy action for non-expert users. So that's where designers and data scientists have to learn how to speak each other's language. And so what you may hear in both of these examples is that one of the big challenges and one of the factors to success is helping the different expert teams, whether that's researchers, strategists, data scientists, or designers, helping them learn the language of their craft and discipline, and know that when I say a model, that it means the same thing as it means for the data scientists. Because we are all experts in our discipline, but the words that we say may not mean the same things to our colleagues who are experts in another discipline. So we have to work together in building a common understanding of what we do, that the words mean what we think they mean. We have to learn about what assumptions we make, what our work outputs are, how different groups can use our work outputs. So for example, how can designers use outputs from data science models and how they can be represented correctly without losing their meaning. So these are some of the challenges of learning to work together with cross-disciplinary teams.
Yeah, I think speaking the same language is kind mm-hmm. of like one of the bigger challenges.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, recently I saw an article by MIT which stated the idea of influencing dreams, mm-hmm. which is like the most protected form of data in the world. Because yeah, you can't access someone's dreams, but now it seems otherwise. What are some of the ways you think that this could be useful?
Yeah, I also read maybe half a year ago another science article where dreamers were able to communicate back to the researcher. I think it was something to do with the dreamer being able to count and report back to the researcher something that they were counting. It was actually an experiment, which I found very, very fascinating, and it also sounded very much like sci-fi. Yeah. So I think dreams are really interesting because we have, as humans, we have a lot of perceptions and ideas about what dreams are and what they mean and what kind of information they may reveal about us. I don't know if you've ever experienced a dream book, but there are publications that say, well, if you dream about your teeth falling out, it means that this or this or this will happen. But if you dream that you are eating cake, it actually means something else will happen.
That sounds so funny.
Right. But we as humans believe that our dreams have some very hidden meaning.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. Going back to your question, how do you think it would be useful to influence dreams? Cognitive neuroscientists actually study dreams. And one of the things that I know about dreams is that we have a lot of evidence to show that our memories become consolidated or strengthened when we dream. So it helps with the learning process for us as humans. When we do an activity, then we go to sleep, and in the sleep, that memory becomes strengthened. So I think if we can influence dreams, perhaps we can help people learn things better or faster. But that is to be seen. I am sure that there's still a lot of research to be done in this area.
I am like the most optimistic person, but still I think in the future, it could be possible that dreams could be used for advertising. Like that's like a very like...
It's very dystopian.
Yeah, a very dystopian thought. I heard this in a talk by a professor, I forgot his name. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so like, it was like gamifying the concept of advertisements in dreams. So for example, if you saw some advertisement in a dream and you remember it the next day, then you'll be getting some points for that. So, and that makes it even worse.
That's where I look to futurism for hope. If we anticipate such a future and we really don't like that idea, I hope that we can rally around a future where that does not become a reality.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. Do you think we can dream intentionally?
I am sure that some people would say that they can, but I don't know what science says about it.
Yeah, very, very. I think that's the end of curiosity for many people. You know, is it safe to assume that with the amount of data we'll be able to map, like now as we're exploring dreams as well, we may reach a stage that we could successfully predict the future?
I think this is a very broad and deep question. What is the future? Is it the future for each individual person or for us as a society as a whole? Based on what I've read and I've heard experts talk about, I think that the answer is no. Okay. I mean, we cannot even predict the weather, really, right? So how can we predict the future? And it's also, you know, we are collecting much more data today than we're able to process. There are many, many nuances and factors that influence any given situation. And it is very difficult to account for all those factors. And it's also from the computational point of view, we don't have enough computing power to crunch the numbers. Like we don't have enough computing power to calculate certain things that astrophysicists would like to know. And that's, I think, a more defined space, you know, outer space that we want to understand and model. I feel like predicting the future for humans would be an even larger scale, but I could be wrong. I also want to think that as humans, we have some degree of spontaneity, which could make predicting our own choices and decisions even harder for ourselves or for our friends or family members. Going back to the business, who would want to predict the future for all of us and spend all of that, you know, resource saying like, oh, in the next 5 minutes, you're going to do this activity. Why does it matter to know that? And do we need to crunch data or can we use some heuristics to anticipate what people might do? I think there's an impact and effort balance that needs to be evaluated.
Yeah, I think when you said that, why does it matter to predict the future? In case it's dystopian, then it really matters, I think. That's my thought. And, you know, with quantum computing coming up, I think after a certain point in future, we may be able to successfully predict the future, but it may be a very far years from now. But
yeah,
let's see what happens. Yeah. And what are your thoughts like from the transition from Web 2 to Web 3? What are your thoughts on this transition?
So I don't know enough about Web 3 to have strong and informed opinions. What I do know is that Web 3 promises much more data privacy. And so I am a strong proponent of data privacy and not monetizing on people's data. So if Web3 delivers that future, I am excited about it.
Yeah. You're one of your tweet, explored this concept of a ring, like an incognito mode for real life, which was like really fascinating to me. I read about it, like it's just one switch that transforms your real life into like undercover agent type of thing. But yeah.
Yes, it was a concept. I don't remember the name of the firm who built the concept, but it's the idea that by putting on a ring, we can easily hide our private data from entities that are in our external world that may be kind of scanning the environment, such as, you know, trying to scan our face or tracking our phone to determine where we're going. And so by manipulating this ring, we can either turn our information on or turn it off, depending on the context in which we find ourselves. So if we walk into a store and we want to see promotions that are available to us, we turn our personal data on so that we're presented with the relevant information effectively. But if we are at a political rally or some other event where we don't want to be recognized as a specific type of individual or even identified as, you know, I'm Jane Smith, then we would could potentially use that type of a device to turn that information off. The team that created the concept does recognize that they are that for that type of a ring to be effective, tech companies and governments and the society have to be aligned on creating an environment in which this would actually work. Yeah. But it's a potential future. If we want that to be a reality, we can advocate for it.
Yeah. The idea is very simple, but implementing it is very, very difficult because like that getting permission from every firm and the government itself, that's like, it will take a lot of time. And then the company's name was Me. So it's like me.ring. Mm. So yeah.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. So what's one piece of advice that you would like to say to designers who are just entering, just getting started?
I think I would recommend to anyone moving into any field is to learn from many designers and many different experts. So not to get tied to one train of thought or one way of doing things, but to immerse yourself in the space and learn from many different experts, looking to design mentors and design networks that you are able to network with, to learn and find where it is that you feel most comfortable and what you find most exciting in that big space, such as design.
Yeah. And now I feel really good that I started this podcast because this was the sole reason of starting it. And now that you have said it, like I'm feeling really good about it. So yeah, now we'll move to rapid fire. So I'll ask you 9 questions and you have to answer each question in 10 seconds. Okay?
Sure.
Your favorite book?
I've read Harry Potter twice, so I'll go with that.
Okay. A song that reminds you of the past?
Probably in a Nirvana song. I listened to that in my teens.
Okay, a song that reminds you of the future?
That one I cannot answer.
Why?
I don't know.
Okay, no problem. Your most used app?
Calendar, email, physical activity tracker, Overdrive for audiobooks.
Mine is the alarm clock.
I do not use an alarm clock on my phone.
Your most used emoji?
It's the one that's laughing with tears. It's the joy emoji. And I've read recently that I am reflecting that by using that emoji, I show to people that I'm old in age because only old people use that outdated emoji. I still love it.
I use the one with the tears. That's my favorite. What does it say? Do you remember?
It's called joy in Slack, but... Yeah. Okay. Laughing with
and what
tears.
What does my emoji say? Like, if in case you remember that, my age. That thought.
Oh, it just younger people think that old people use the laughing with tears emoji.
Oh, which country would you want to visit one day?
Ireland, Britain, Scotland. I don't know in which order.
Oh, that's very specific. Your favorite class when you were in university?
I loved calculus, statistics, and then neuroanatomy class where we had to do sheep brain dissection.
That's so cool. A person you look up to?
I admire Dan Price. He's a progressive CEO here in the United States. So I admire his views and actions as a CEO in a corporate America.
Dan Price, CEO of Gravity Payments, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I also follow him. Fiction or nonfiction?
Why not both?
That's the best answer for sure. Thanks a lot for being on the show, Evelina. It was really, really great talking to you. Hope you have a great day ahead.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hey, thanks a lot for sticking till the end. Hope you had an amazing time. You can find the links to Evelina's social handle in the description below. And if you enjoyed this episode, do give us a rating and subscribe on Spotify or wherever you listen. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram @MilliSecondsHQ for more updates. For any questions or feedback regarding the podcast, you can email me at MilliSecondsHQ@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Cheers!